power of the cosmic Christ to descend into the earth.
And when he'd opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour.
Внимание, 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 уважаемые.
It had begun just like an eclipse. The sun blotted out, turned black behind a torrential hot rain of falling cinders. No one knew what was happening. This had never happened before. In an instant, the entire sky was a blazing horror. The noonday bright clear blue replaced by a searing blood-red sheet of fire. In a single day, it had begun and ended.
The earth dies screaming.
I'm talking about end times. Oh, I've got powdered food.
Doomsday Daydreams.
Winds pushed the ash east into communities like Yakima, turning Sunday noon into the dead of night. Residents were issued gas masks and sent respiratory patients to hospitals. Cars stalled on the streets when the dense ash stopped up carburetors and air filters, and police told everybody just to stay in the homes. We have a number of reports tonight. David Jackson is right now at the base of Mount St. Helens. David, what's happening?
Well, Richard, as we've been telling you all day, the mountain up, of course, in its largest eruption ever, and tonight...
In the spring of 1980, in the Pacific Northwest, Mount St. Helens erupted. My family had recently left Seattle and moved to Denver, but in my six-year-old mind, I felt like we had barely escaped a disaster. I imagined Seattle was destroyed by lava flow, the house we had recently moved out of dissolving in a lake of molten fire, along with the rest of the city. A little bit later on, I gained a more realistic view of the eruption from a coffee table picture book my parents had. I would lay on the floor, paging through it, mesmerized. There was a series of black and white images, first of a small amount of smoke leaking out of the peak of the mountain, and then a massive plume of rock and clouds shooting out of the top of it. And then, the front side of the mountain just sort of crumples inwards. There were photos of logging equipment engulfed in a sea of gray sludge, their yellow paint barely visible as they sank into the muck. There were pictures of cars and trees submerged in lava and mud. There were images of downed trees, acres and acres of forest just flattened all the way down to the front of the mountain. And then there were photos of people in a nearby town with handkerchiefs over their faces, shoveling ash off of the sidewalks and cars like the snow from some obscene gray blizzard. Probably the most famous picture is of a beat-up orange car, a Pinto or something, with a motorbike attached to it, stopped sideways in the middle of a dirt road. There are dark green pine trees on either side, and between the trees is the erupting mountain in the background, frozen in time, just before a massive wall of black smoke and ash comes crashing down on everything. It's a remarkable photo, and Richard Lasher, the man who took the picture, barely escaped with his life. Around this same time, I learned about Pompeii in a National Geographic magazine my parents also had. Quick aside, right after I learned to read, my mom found me reading a Time magazine commemorating Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I was both terrified of and drawn to images of destruction, and there were plenty of books and magazines lying around for me to feed this fascination. In the National Geographic issue on Pompeii, I remember seeing the images of plaster casts of the bodies of people, their mouths frozen in agony, the barren, empty streets, the buildings without tops. I think I was worried about Seattle because I had kind of conflated the two events in my mind. I assumed that any mountain could be a volcano, and when any volcano erupted, what happened to the people at Pompeii is pretty much what would happen to anyone near a volcano. First, there would be an explosion, and then, like what happens when you mix vinegar and baking soda in a bottle, the lava would flow. And whatever city you were living in would just get buried. And centuries later, you'd be discovered by curious archaeologists. And later still, shown to teachers in a trifold cardboard display. I liked worrying about things when I was a kid, so it was great to have a new fear that I could plug into my existing ones, like throwing up or tornadoes or nuclear war. Of course, we were safe from the eruption at Mount St. Helens because we didn't live anywhere near there, and seismologists and volcanologists were able to give the people who did advance warning that the mountain was going to explode, and most people were able to evacuate in time. Well, except for this guy, improbably named Harry Truman. He refused to leave his lodge at the bottom of Spirit Lake at the foot of the mountain. The whole area was covered in a massive 30-foot-high mudslide, and Harry was never seen again. The people of Pompeii, on the other hand, had no modern warning system, of course. Mount Vesuvius had been rumbling and smoking for a few days, as it had been doing for a few years, when, all of a sudden, the mountain explodes. Volcanic lightning caused by static electricity crashes all around, and a plume of smoke and ash shoots out into the air. Dark red clouds spread out into the blue August sky, blotting out the sun, darkening the two cities below. Searing hot volcanic stones, called lapilli, rain down on the city, and smoke and ash choke the air. Over the next 2 days, there are four more volcanic surges, each producing waves of superheated air, mudslides, and a steady shower of ash and fiery lapilli that bring destruction and death down on the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. Some people fled to the sea, others hid in their houses and tried to survive, but the destruction was immense. Now, we know a lot of the details about this because of someone named Pliny the Younger. From the relative safety of the city of Napoli, across the bay, he wrote about his uncle, a Roman naval and army commander named Gaius Plinius Secundus, also known as...
Pliny the Elder was a naturalist. He wrote books about the natural world. He was stationed right outside of Naples as on this naval base. And when the volcano started erupting, he wanted to see it in person because he was a scientist. So he got in his ship and sailed off to go get closer to the volcano and try to rescue people.
This, by the way, is Summer Trenton. Summer is an art historian with a focus on Roman art who has worked on location in Pompeii. Anyway, back to Pliny.
Pliny the Elder sailed to the home of one of his friends who lived probably near Herculaneum, and attempted to get close to the shore, but he couldn't because of all the lapilli that were floating in the water. And he went to the villa of his friend, and they tried to carry on like normal. They were drinking and eating and stuff. And then they tied pillows to their heads to protect them from the debris that was falling from the sky. And he couldn't leave the harbor, so he wasn't able to rescue as many people as he hoped. And eventually he succumbed to the gases probably from the volcano and died on the beach.
I talked to Summer to get a fuller picture of how we came to our understanding of this event through the uncovering of art and artifacts. She told me that while there was a larger rescue effort that came from Rome, this was really more of an evacuation. After all, Pompeii and Herculaneum were covered in 75 feet of mud, ash, pumice stone, and lava. And actually, you know what? Let's just let this film strip from the Bristol Community College finish this thought for me.
The ancient Roman town of Pompeii was dead. A few fragments rose above the cinders to mark the spot where only yesterday a city of 20,000 had pulsed with life. Herculaneum, its neighbor, was totally obliterated. Not a trace remained. Neither Herculaneum nor Pompeii would see the light of day again for almost 2,000 years.
So, Pompeii became sort of a rumor of a city, which is kind of unusual in the world. I mean, there just aren't a lot of completely abandoned cities in general. Even a small town like Centralia, Pennsylvania, which was abandoned because of an underground coal fire that started in the 1960s and is still going today, Even that place has a handful of people living there now. But Pompeii was largely forgotten. And so, we're just going to go ahead and skip forward about 1700 years. And this is where we'll find Pompeii, still just sitting there, buried under all that rubble and mud. A pyroclastic El Dorado, complete with treasures just waiting to be exhumed. Which brings us to
1711, which is the year, I believe, that peasants were digging around in the environs of Pompeii and discovered kind of hidden treasures and ruins and things that were sticking out. I think they were actually digging a well, if memory serves. In the process of digging the well, they came across foundations or sculptures or something that initiated the now famous excavations at Pompeii and Herculaneum.
This is Brad Mudge. Brad is an 18th century literature professor and my friend. And if you want to talk about anything that happened in that century, he's pretty willing. So, a bunch of people are digging up Pompeii, but...
At that point, archaeology was not a very... It was not really a discipline that was done with any sort of ethics or accountability. So basically everything belonged to the king. And if people found like a painting or a sculpture that the king liked, then, you know, it got shipped to the palace. If there was something that the king didn't like or didn't fit into the narrative of what people wanted Roman art to be, then it was destroyed. So the early excavators actually destroyed a lot of stuff that was found in Pompeii, just so nobody else could get their hands on it, which is kind of upsetting. And they didn't record anything. And even into the 19th century, early excavation reports are so frustrating to read. They'd be like, we excavated 8 houses today. We found like 7 statues, 23 terracotta pots, 4 lamps, and that's it. They don't say like where, what room they were in, like anything. So it's very difficult to get any sort of accurate record of what was actually found in these spaces. And a lot of that stuff, even if it's recorded, the stuff itself has just been lost. It was like given to some dignitary or just went into storage and people lost track of it. So yeah, it's had a kind of a troubling history, and just a lot of things weren't saved early on. People didn't see the value in like a scrap of wood or, you know, a potsherd. They only wanted a bronze statue or a painting showing Hercules or something like that. So they didn't bother to keep anything that might give us a more nuanced view of what people's daily lives were like.
The excavation at Pompeii was initiated by King Charles III, if you were in Spain, or Charles VII, if you were in the city-states of Napoli or Sicily. And yes, those are the same guy. Anyway, the gold rush of people wanting to experience and, frankly, empty Pompeii of its treasures was on. Grand tour travelers and other adventurers, mostly from Great Britain, flocked to the area. And they were finding all these fabulous things to take home and put on their shelves. And by the way, if you're thinking that there's a connection between tourism and colonization, you're right, but maybe that's a topic for another day. So, as these guys went about their adventuring, and the workers went about their digging, the site started to become about more than just pretty antiquities to hoard away. People naturally got curious. They wanted to understand who lived in Pompeii, or what daily life was like in ancient Rome. And perhaps more germane to our discussion, they began looking for answers as to why this important trading city was seemingly wiped off the face of the earth.
Pompeii was like discovering a Polaroid, you know, beneath a layer of dirt. They were uncovering something that they had never expected to completely understand. And so there's both a mystery, there's a significant part of what they don't know about what caused the eruptions and what people were doing and whether there were moral or immoral origins to the disaster. All of these, there are a number of great unknowns, but the increasing number of knowns was intoxicating. So it became a kind of microcosm of the macrocosm. If the fascination generally is with the rise and fall of the Roman Empire and needing to understand that for the contemporary cultural moment, then Pompeii was this sort of a cheater's guide to the fall of the Roman Empire. And it was viewed largely in that way.
So, keeping in mind that archaeology was kind of being invented on the fly, all of this also occurred during a time of massive colonial expansion and empire building. So the people doing this excavation brought, you know, that whole value system with them wherever they went. So I want to emphasize this question here.
Whether there were moral or immoral origins to the disaster.
That may sound a little like a left field idea, but this notion is actually really important to the way people began to interpret their new discovery.
Nobody actually knew what a Roman house or even a Roman city like actually looked like until Pompeii and Herculaneum were discovered in the first half of the 18th century. So it kind of revolutionized the way people thought about the Roman Empire. And they found a lot more X-rated art than they intended. They were pretty disturbed about that. So the guidebooks from then are so funny. They're like, well, we won't even mention the paintings in this house because they're so immoral. But if you want to see it, you can bribe the guards and let you in. So don't go there because it's an affront to human decency. But if you want to, you can.
Our intrepid explorers felt that what they stumbled upon was just straight-up debauchery, the kind of indignities that needed to be hidden from a decent Christian society. Was it titillating? Well, yes, but highly immoral.
They uncover these great statues with enlarged male genitalia, and the initial question was, oh my God, is this, you know, the classical version of a hat rack? I mean, this is where we're supposed to leave our togas or put our umbrellas, or, you know, what possible use could these serve? And these images, frescoes as well as statues, seem to be in moral conflict with the strength of the empire and the origins of democracy and governance and the reach of empire. And now we have versions of well-known mythological tales, but we have versions that are twisting and turning our accepted knowledge in new directions. And people were dramatically puzzled by this.
To the thinking at the time in the 18th century, this wasn't just some unlucky plate tectonic shift that led to two cities being obliterated. This whole thing seemed, well, kind of biblical.
This is well ingrained in 18th century culture, concern with excess. They were concerned with how much money is too much money, how much sugar is too much sugar, how much alcohol is too much alcohol, how much sex is too much sex. So this notion of excess was very important to the mid-18th century, with the kind of gradual realization that it was middle class moderation which provided the solution to the dilemma, because the aristocracy was perpetually overindulging. The lower classes were similarly overindulging, and yet it was the industrious middle class who could kind of strike the balance. So looking back at the Roman Empire, looking back at Pompeii, looking at a series of incomprehensible, obscene objects, they are seeing a kind of decadence that they tied to the end of the empire.
The people discovering Pompeii saw its destruction as a punishment for the Pompeian people's decadence, for all of Rome's decadence, really. And if you squint your eyes, maybe you can see why they thought that way. Beyond just Pompeii, there were the stories of the misbehavior of Rome's later period emperors and their appetites for debauchery. So, was it possible that this catastrophe was just something that happened? No.
The idea that the world is arbitrary, that disasters could be neutral in origin, that they simply are fortuitous. That was not an accepted mode of interpretation, so it was far easier for them to look for a moral cause.
In that sense, the Roman Empire got what it deserved. Their degeneracy was rightly punished, and our proto-archaeologists saw another lesson to be learned here as well. They saw that there was a clear set of behaviors to be avoided, and in so doing, they would not incur God's wrath and possible destruction.
So archaeology is the uncovering, the revealing of the ruins of the past, but there's also a prophetic quality to it. They are ruins that prophesize a certain kind of moral lesson, and that we ignore that lesson at our ill, right? So, you know, I think that's the interesting thing about Pompeii in a nutshell, is that it's a kind of Janus figure moment, in that it looks back and it gives us knowledge about the past, but the lessons that it has written deeply within it are lessons that we take forward to the future.
I recently read about some new evidence that shows when Vesuvius erupted, a wave of superheated gas more than 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit came down the mountain, almost instantly vaporizing the people in the closer town of Herculaneum. Part of the evidence for this was the recently discovered piece of someone's brain that had been turned to glass from that heat wave. The destruction from any volcano is enormous. The heat, fire, lava, and falling debris destroy almost everything in the immediate area. And then there's the gas that asphyxiates anything that breathes, and the mudslides, the collapsing buildings, choking clouds of ash, and that's only in the first few hours. But not all mountains are volcanoes. There's no risk of, say, Mount Everest or K2 exploding catastrophically. The idea of a huge swath of the world's population dying in a volcanic explosion probably isn't going to happen. But I say probably because there was actually a massive volcanic eruption relatively recently, geologically speaking anyway, that resulted in the creation of the area we now know as the Yellowstone Caldera. The geysers and the sulfur pools and all of that, they're part of the after effects of this supervolcano. And this was a cataclysmic and world-altering event, but it did happen roughly 2 million years ago. So, you know, it's not really a pressing concern now. Anyway, this is the kind of thought I would calm myself with as a kid. The Rocky Mountains were not going to explode and shower lava down on Denver anytime soon. But here's the thing. Volcanoes can have effects on the whole world, and not just in the way a 10-year-old would think. And those effects, as we'll find out soon, are when things can get a little weird. But before we leave Pompeii and Vesuvius behind, there was one last thing that Summer said that really stuck out to me during our interview, and I don't want it to get overlooked in this discussion.
I think there's still that fascination today with this idea of death, and it's really kind of grim and gruesome to look upon these people in their last agonizing moments of life. It's kind of strange because I love working at the site. It's a beautiful site. It's nice to be able to go to places where tourists can't go, and it's very peaceful, and you can hear birds and smell like the wild, like arugula that grows everywhere. And it's just like beautiful and peaceful. And then you kind of remember, like, this is a mass grave site, which is a really, maybe humbling is the word. It's just a really eerie feeling to be walking around in the shadows and the shells of what was once somebody's everyday life. So it's a really kind of moving experience, and sometimes you forget about it and then you realize, like, it comes back, like, oh, somebody died here. This is somebody's, you know, mundane life, and then we know about it because of this cataclysmic event that probably killed that individual. So it's a profound experience.
Since everyone's anguish is our own, we live ours over again. Thin child clutching your mother convulsively, as though when the noon sky turned black, you wanted to re-enter her. To no avail, because the air turned poison, filtered to find you through the closed windows of your quiet, thick-walled house, once happy with your song, your timid laugh. Centuries have passed. The ash has petrified to imprison those delicated limbs forever. In this way, you stay with us, a twisted plaster cast, agony without end, terrible witness to how much our proud seed matters to the gods. Nothing is left of your far-removed sister, the Dutch girl imprisoned by four walls who wrote of her youth without tomorrows. Her silent ash was scattered by the wind, her brief life shut in a crumpled notebook. Nothing remains of the Hiroshima schoolgirl, a shadow printed on the wall by the light of a thousand suns, victim sacrificed on the altar of fear. Powerful of the earth, masters of new poisons, sad secret guardians of final thunder, the torments heaven sends us are enough. Before your finger presses down, stop and consider.
Now, at the risk of sounding like a high school term paper, I think it's probably important that we define just what apocalypse actually means. And if we start with the word itself, well, it's a Greek word whose direct translation is to be revealed. The word's origins are biblical, think Book of Revelation. And we'll get deeper into that whole thing in another episode, but we need a little space to go over that. So let's just look at the word apocalypse in our modern vernacular. We now mean the word apocalypse to say an event of mass destruction on a global scale, and
the destruction always brings with it a concomitant illumination, a cause, right? So it's not simply an event of mass destruction. It's an event of mass destruction that has a certain kind of lesson. And that's the fascination and the mystery. And you could probably take it right back to our traditional beginning point, right? The beginning of the Old Testament, the account in Genesis of the fall of man. And it's that myth, that originary myth. How are human beings created? Why do we die? Why do women experience pain in childbirth? Why do men have to work for a living? All of these human miseries that go back to an original transgression. Where the fascination is understanding the cause of that transgression, and that's the understanding prohibits the repetition. So we can avoid that fate if we learn from it.
This is Brad Mudge again. Brad always likes to tell me that everything important to our modern world happened in the 18th century, and in this case, the case of Pompeii and how it informs modern apocalyptic thinking, this is no different. Because there were plenty of things happening outside of the discovery of Pompeii to kind of help set the mood a little bit.
If we were thinking about types of destruction for the 18th century, you could have a geologic disaster. You could have a disaster of disease. You could have plague. You could have smallpox. You could have syphilis. You could have a disaster of war, the ongoing battles between English and the French, and, you know, the amazing Napoleonic Wars, which ended at the Battle of Waterloo, and 27,000 people die over the course of 3 days. And then you have political disasters, of course, right? You have the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror. You have the specter of revolution, the turning of upside down of cherished values, that the world might end by inept, greedy, lustful, ignorant politicians, or scientific disasters, that knowledge could somehow progress without our control, and we could have a kind of Frankenstein-esque moment where Dr. Frankenstein creates a monster that's beyond his ability to monitor. So all of those versions of apocalypse are part of and contribute to the way it would have functioned in the 18th century.
I'm glad Brad mentioned Frankenstein there, because I'm going to use that as a way to take us on a little side trip to Switzerland and Lake Geneva in June of the year 1816. Lake Geneva is a crescent-shaped lake situated at the foot of the Swiss Alps. It's a bucolic lake, dramatically surrounded by snow-capped peaks, a deep green forest, and beautiful Swiss chalet villas lining the shore.
Introducing the Swiss Riviera, beautiful playground and haven for millions since first the scenic and climatic wonders of this region were discovered. Lake Geneva, or as the French would have it, Lac Leman, has been the subject of countless lyric poems and essays, thousands of enthusiastic letters home, and no wonder. Today, fabulous hotels line the shores where Julius Caesar and his men once trod. This is ancient territory, romantically beautiful, restful to the eyes, and refreshing to the spirit. It's the Swiss Riviera. Happy holiday home.
In one such villa, Diodati, if you're curious, we find four people, the authors Mary Wollstonecraft, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Lord Byron, and Byron's doctor, and admirer, John William Polidori. And even though it's summer, they've been inside most of the time. The weather has been pretty inhospitable, rainy, cold, even snowy, what Mary Wollstonecraft later referred to as a wet, ungenial summer. This dreary weather has them hanging around inside the house, staying up until the late hours, drinking wine, doing opium, and talking about big philosophical ideas like the nature of life, mankind's now possibly shaky dominion over the planet, and the possibility of all of this life coming to an end. Now, on one particularly stormy weekend, Lord Byron comes up with an idea. Each of them is to write the scariest thing they can think of. So they all go off to their various secluded corners and they start to work. Byron comes up with an idea for a vampire story with a probably working title called Fragment of a Novel. Polidori makes up an apparently forgettable story that night, but later that summer borrows Byron's vampire story Fragment for his novel called The Vampire, which itself becomes an inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mary Wollstonecraft, who would soon become Mary Shelley, started writing easily the best and certainly the most famous work produced from that time, which she called The Modern Prometheus, or Frankenstein. I'm sure there's enough material for a podcast episode about just those works, but we're kind of more focused on the apocalypse here, so we'll have to let that go. Oh, Percy Shelley didn't really produce anything that night, but we're not quite done with him yet. What's maybe the most important thing to this story, during that wet, ungenial summer, Lord Byron produced what is likely the first English language work of apocalyptic fiction, a poem called Darkness.
I had a dream which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went and came and brought no day. And men forgot their passions in the dread of this desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light. And they did live by watchfires, and the thrones, the palaces of crowned kings, the huts, the habitations of all things which dwell, were burnt for beacons. Cities were consumed, and men were gathered round their blazing homes to look once more into each other's face. Happy were those who dwelt within the eye of the volcanoes and their mountain torch. A fearful hope was all the world contained. Forests were set on fire, but hour by hour they fell and faded, and the crackling trunks extinguished with a crash, and all was
blown. There are two questions you've no doubt thought of. One, why were these people exploring these dark and terrifying ideas? And two, why were they stuck inside the house in a beautiful place like Lake Geneva in the middle of the summer? To answer those questions, we need to go back 1 year earlier and a half a world away to 1815 and a tropical mountain called Tambora, which is in the center of a lush green Indonesian island in the Philippine Sea. Mount Tambora had been rumbling and smoking for a little while, and then, in an eruption hundreds of times more powerful than Vesuvius, there's a tremendous explosion and a cloud of smoke and fire shoots out of the mountain, showering debris and poisonous gas down on the area below. Tens of thousands of people in the immediate vicinity are killed almost instantly, and tens of thousands of others die in the following days and weeks. They were first killed by the heat wave, poisonous gas, choking on ash, the falling debris, lava flow, but later by a lack of access to clean water and food. The ash was so thick in the area that to even try to reach the island, ships had to basically plow through it like snow. Tambora's eruption was the largest in recorded history, and it almost completely leveled the mountain. But the eruption itself was only the beginning. What happened next was far more global. This volcanic eruption launched 12 cubic miles of dirt and debris more than 25 miles up into the Earth's atmosphere. Slowly, over the course of the next year, this dust cloud would come to envelop almost the entire planet. People everywhere experienced dim, gloomy days, much colder temperatures, and weird weather, including snow in the summer. There was a strange, dry, yellow fog called a stratospheric sulfate aerosol veil, and this veil settled on top of cities and towns and villages all over the world. Of course, all of this led to a lowering of the global temperature, which made it difficult to grow crops, resulting in widespread famine everywhere. That, of course, led to food riots and civil unrest. In Europe, a typhus epidemic and a cholera pandemic broke out. And it's important to note that people didn't really understand why these things were happening. Most people were unaware of Tambora's eruption. This was early in the 1800s, after all. Communication didn't move quickly, and geology as a science didn't really exist yet, to say nothing of climatology. As far as anyone could see, the sun just seemed to be weakening in the sky, its color more red than yellow. Its life-giving rays just weren't reaching the Earth all the way. It was an event that would become known as the Year Without a Summer. And although our four people in Lake Geneva traveled there from London to get away from all of this, they couldn't. So naturally, this led our authors to have somewhat gloomy thoughts. As I mentioned earlier, there was an accepted idea of the time that mankind had a rightful place at the top of the food chain, and that the Earth was the dominion of man. This event, and others of course, called that accepted idea into question. And this was the beginning of a change in thinking that had reverberations going forward into the future. Finally, just as a footnote to all of this, a few years later, Mary Shelley wrote another book, and this one was called The Last Man, and it takes place in the 21st century and involves a group of people struggling for survival while a plague ravages the world. The destruction of the towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum and the fall of the Roman Empire seemed unfathomable to people in the late 18th and early 19th century. If a once mighty and proud empire could fall, what did that say about their own? What sort of forces could possibly bring about their own ruin?
I would draw your attention to the correspondence between the millennialism that we see at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century, this fascination with apocalypse and destruction. And I would suggest that it's linked directly to the revolutions that transformed the political systems in both France and America. So we have the rather violent birth of democracy. We have ideas about individuality that turned over neoclassical truisms about the power of the collective and our responsibilities to each other. And so from, say, 1776 through the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, the world itself seemed to be in unending tumult. So it makes perfect sense that the idea of the apocalypse would surface yet again, and it would be a thing to be considered along with the chaos of the contemporary moment. How could we possibly navigate these dangerous channels? What are the lessons? What are the guides? What pathways should we follow? What pathways should we avoid? They seem to cohere in this idea of a doomsday apocalypse. So that apocalypse should attend the birth of modernity makes perfect sense. That sense that we are born again and yet to what great disasters we cannot envision.
I love walking around ruins and abandoned places. I've been to Pompeii and I've seen the ruins there and the plaster casts of bodies. And as Summer said earlier, it is solemn, but for me, it's also really fascinating. You know, years ago, back in the early 90s, there was this abandoned building in my city, a massive old granary that had been empty for years. It was in an industrial part of town that at the time wasn't doing so well. Lots of broken streets, old warehouses, abandoned buildings, and these three viaducts that went above the whole area. Rising out of all of this was this building, a gray concrete silo, kind of circular on one side and square on the other. It was maybe 15 stories high, and there's nothing else around it. Just crumbling old roads, bricks, dirt. It felt like something right out of a post-apocalyptic movie. And one night, we even snuck into it on a dare. There were unhoused people here and there, bumming cigarettes and change from us. We went up as high as we could go, marveling at the view and the situation we were in. It was equal parts terrifying and exhilarating. And there's something of a magnetic pull to a place like that. It feels like visiting a place where a civilization has ended. Places like that building, or Pompeii, or an old abandoned mining town, kind of exist in a liminal space between the past and present, between apocalypse and civilization. Of course, that building is luxury condos now. In fact, the entire area has been revitalized. The rubble replaced by parks, more luxury condos, and a Whole Foods.
The contemplation of ruins is both a contemplation of the past and a projection onto the future, the recognition not only of individual mortality, but of collective mortality, that these things that we've dedicated our lives to celebrating and defending, whether we call them American or British or French or European or Asian or African, it doesn't matter, but that they too will pass. You know, there's a great poem by Shelley, Ozymandias, where he has his traveler from an antique land tell the story about the statue of Ramses, which is lying fragmented in the desert. And Shelley wrote that particular poem about the power of time and of history and the inconsequence of political life, cultural life, you know, that the human claim to immortality is absolutely nil and foolish.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear: My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away."
As Brad mentioned, that was Percy Shelley, one of our Lake Geneva residents and Marie Shelley's husband. He's expressing an idea of impermanence here, that no matter how important someone is or how grand the things they've built are, this may all be for nothing. The longer the arc of history, the less important these individuals and their works become. Maybe that's a little part of what the fascination with the apocalypse is. We're afraid of death, sure. That permeates all we do as humans. But the fear of apocalypse is also the fear of being erased, that everything we've accomplished as humans was for nothing. It's interesting to me, though, that we love to explore the post-apocalyptic in these ruins and these liminal spaces. In countless movies and video games and books, we love to imagine the world without us, or without very many of us anyway. And yet, even with all of this, we seem to be really good at ignoring something maybe a little more pressing.
We call it the Anthropocene. We have, for the first time in history since really the beginning of the period we're discussing, the Industrial Revolution in the mid-18th century, we've doctored our own environment in such a way that we're causing our own apocalyptic moment. So there's been no divine intervention whatsoever. We've brought it on rather nicely ourselves.
I grew up in the 1980s, so I really became aware of the world during the threat of nuclear annihilation. I would stay up at night worrying about it, along with those other fears I mentioned. But unlike quicksand, nuclear war felt more real, more threatening. And I wasn't alone. The apocalypse was in the air then. There were movies like War Games, where Matthew Broderick almost causes and then barely prevents a nuclear war. This was a fun family movie, by the way. There was The Road Warrior, with its over-the-top costumes and cars and violence as people battled for oil in a post-nuclear wasteland. There was more serious fare, too, like the TV movie Threads and The Day After, where the filmmakers would try to show America what nuclear war would actually look like. No leather outfits, no modified cars here, just regular people trying to survive after a nuclear exchange with the USSR. I watched The Road Warrior and The Day After through my fingers, terrified for different reasons. In the news, there were things like Chernobyl and the Soviet Union, which was the evil empire, and I was sure that President Reagan was going to get us all killed. All of these things and more grew into a kind of a generalized fascination with the apocalypse for me. That fascination never really went away, even after the Cold War ended and Y2K fizzled out. And I know I'm not alone there either. A lot of people are fascinated with the apocalypse. So, I want to explore what we all find so fascinating about the idea of the end of the world. And in doing so, I also want to try and understand why it is that faced with our own actual apocalypse, one that we can see the effects of right now, we are so willing to ignore it.
Doomsday Daydreams was written, produced, and edited by me, Josh Madison. I had research help from Ryan Connell and Brad Mudge. Also, Gray Newman was a huge help conceiving and focusing this project and working on the scoring music. You heard Gray's beautiful score underneath the Primo Levi poem, Girl Child of Pompeii, which was read by Ellen Graham. Speaking of Ellen, extra special thanks to her for suggesting and producing the live show for this and helping push this rickety whole thing to the finish line. If you want to reach out to me, you can visit me on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky. I'll have links to all that in the show notes. And speaking of the show notes, you can find additional credits for the score there as well. Again, I've been Josh Madison, and this was Doomsday Daydreams. Next time, what happens when half the population is wiped out by a plague? What kind of effect does that have on the human psyche? We explore the bubonic plague, and we learn the dance of death.